Narayanam namaskrityam Naram chaiva narottamam Devim sarstim vyasam Tato jayam udirayat Nasta praishu abhadreshu Nityang bhagavata sevaya Bhagavat yutama shloke Bhakti bhavati naishtiki Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Reading today from Canto 5, Chapter 6, entitled The Activities of Lord Rishabhadev, and text number 13. Tasya nagunan slokan gayanti Aho bhuva sapta samudra vatya Dipeshu vashesh vadipunya metat Gayanti yatraya Janamurare Karmani Badranyavataravanti Tasya of him, Lord Rishabhadev, Anugunan. Conforming to the instructions for liberation. Slokan, verses. Gayanti, chant. Aho, O. Bhuvaha, of this earthly planet. Sapta Samudravatya, possessing seven seas. Dvipeshu, among the islands. Varsheshu, among the lands. Adipunyam, more pious than any other island. Etat, this. Bhatavasha. Gayanti, sing about Yatracha Janaha, the people of this tract of land. Murare, of Murari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Karmani, the activities. Bhadrani, all auspicious. Avataravanti, in many incarnations, such as Lord Rishabhadev. Translation. Learned scholars chant about the transcendental qualities of Lord Rishabhadev in this way. Oh, this earthly planet contains seven seas and many islands and lands, of which Bharatavarsha is the most pious, of which Bharatavarsha is considered the most pious. People of Bharatavarsha are accustomed to glorifying the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his incarnations as Lord Rishabhadev and others. All these activities are very auspicious for the welfare of humanity. Please repeat. Learned scholars chant about the transcendental qualities of Lord Rishabhadev in this way. Oh, this earthly planet contains seven seas and many islands and lands, of which Bharatvarsha is considered the most pious. People of Bharatvarsha are accustomed to glorifying the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his incarnations as Lord Rishabhadev and others. All these activities are very auspicious for the welfare of humanity. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Bharata Bhumite Hoila Manusha Janma Yara Janma Sarv Takakari Karapara Upakara. As stated in this verse, Bharatvash is a most pious land. The followers of Vedic literature understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his different incarnations, and they are privileged to glorify the Lord by following the directions of Vedic literature. After realizing the glories of human life, such people should take up the mission to spread the importance of human life throughout the whole world. This is the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. The word Adi Punyam indicates that there are certainly many other pious men throughout the world. But the people of Bharatvarsha are even more pious. I'm going to read that again. I think it's probably significant. The word Adi Punya indicates that there are certainly many other pious men or people throughout the world, but the people of Bharatvarsha are even more pious. Therefore, they are fit to spread Krishna consciousness throughout the world for the benefit of all human society. Srila Madhvacharya also recognizes the land of Bharatvarsha. Visheshad Bharate Punyam. Throughout the world, there is no question of Bhagavat Bhakti or devotional service, but the people of Bharatvarsha can easily understand the devotional service of the Lord. Thus, every inhabitant of Bharatvarsha can cultivate his life by discharging Bhagavat Bhakti and then preaching this cult throughout the world for the benefit of everyone. Tasyana Gunan Slokan Gayanti. Aho bhuva sapta samudravatya dvipeshu vashesh vadipunyam etat gayanti yatratya janamurare karmani badrani avataravanti. Learned scholars chant about the transcendental qualities of Lord Rishabhadev in this way. Oh, this earthly planet contains seven seas and many islands and lands, of which Bharatvarsha is considered the most pious. People of Bharatvarsha are accustomed to glorifying the activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his incarnations as Lord Rishabhadev and others. All these activities are very auspicious for the welfare of humanity. Amagyana timalandasya janandana shalakaya chakshirun militang jena tasmai shi gurave namaha vanchakalpaturuvyascha kripasindubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram 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 Hare Hare. I'd like to explore in the next half hour, two questions. The main question is, in what way is India special? Drawing from this, a second point, If India indeed is special in some real or absolute sense, as this verse seems to imply, what should be our attitude and conduct in relationship to that? In other words, how is that relevant to us in how we act? And also in our attitude, and also in how we act. So two questions. First part, in which way is India special, or in what way is India special? I'd like to look at that in two parts. First, what questions does this raise, India being special? And the second part, I'd like to draw on Shastra to see if we can find some answers to those questions, as suggested in this verse and other parts of Srila Prabhupada's books. Bharatvash. What is Bharat? What is meant by Bharat? The first article of the I'm reading here from Wikipedia, so this is bona fide. The first article of the Constitution of India states that India, that is Bharat, shall be a union of states. Thus India and Bharat are equally official names for the Republic of India. Indians commonly refer to their country as Bharat or India, depending on the context and language of conversation. So Bharatvash, according to the Constitution of India, refers to the nation-state. There may be other meanings, however, of what Bharatvash means. When we talk of a country, what do we mean by that? It may be a geographical tract of land, usually called the subcontinent, the Indian subcontinent. We may also be referring to the people, and there seems to be some indication in this verse also that that could be the case, that it refers to what is sometimes called ethnicity, the particular people who live there. It may have some racial connotations. It may refer to a culture. What are we talking about when we refer to a country? And what are we referring to, or what is Shastra referring to here by Bharatvash, the land of Bharat? We may question whether it actually refers to the nation state itself. However, whatever definition we choose, we need to be careful. Why? Well, there are dangers in thinking that the place of my birth is special. I personally wasn't so convinced that the place of my birth was special, probably because I was born in Birmingham. If anyone's been to Birmingham, you'll know what I mean. Not a very exciting city. Although actually, I will say, despite us being devotees, or at least in a formal sense, that sense of connection with our land of birth probably runs somewhat deeper than we dare to admit or would like to think. It can be very deeply rooted in the heart. I was doing some research, and I'll come to this later, on one song that's sung about the UK, and as I was reading it on the internet, I was feeling extremely patriotic. This is a problem. Why is this a problem? Yasyatmi budhi kunape tu datu ke swati kalitradishi bhoma ijidi yatirtha budhi shalile hikari chit janeshva bigesu sa eva gokaraha. The famous verse, possibly because it's quite hard-hitting at the end. A human being who identifies the body made of three elements as the self. What are those three elements we're talking about here? Because normally there's 24 elements or seven elements. Huh? Kapha, Vata, Pitta. Yeah, the three humours, as they've been called. Humours. Yeah. Those three tendencies, I'm sure all of us have at times worked out whether we're predominantly Vata, Pitta, or Kapha. First, we identify with the body made of the self. Then, this is an extension, one who considers the products of the body to be his kinsman, I'll read it all, who considers the land of his birth to be worshipable, and who goes to a place of pilgrimage simply to take a bath, rather than to meet the men of transcendental knowledge there, is to be considered like a cow or an ass. I believe in Russia there's some case going on at the moment where some Russian people are trying to ban the Bhagavad Gita by Srila Prabhupada, and I think one of the accusations is he calls people, considers them animals or calls them cows, dogs, cats, asses, camels, and other of the more famous members of the animal species. They are, yeah. I think I told the story once a priest came up to me in a town called, I've forgotten the name. It's in Northern Ireland anyway, as we were on Travelling Sankirtan, and this priest came up to me and says, I don't like your spiritual master, because he calls people cats and dogs. To which I replied, what have you got against cats and dogs? But there is a reason, actually, why Srila Prabhupada uses this term. And I'll just explain very, very briefly. Because two reasons are given, one for the ass and one for the cow. For the cow, sometimes when the cow is, in India, when the calf is stillborn, the mother may not give milk, so the farmer will stuff the animal, the tiny calf, and bring it to the mother. And then the mother thinks, oh, here is my baby, and then out of affection she gives milk. But the challenge is that the soul is left, but she still thinks, here is my baby calf. So there is a reason. And Srila Prabhupada mentions that the ass is foolish and is celebrated even amongst other animals for its foolishness. So you can imagine amongst the other animals, they're going to say, here comes the ass again. So they also think it's... And the ass is well known to be foolish, isn't it? It's used as a demonstration of someone who carries a heavy... In our tradition also, someone who carries a heavy load simply to get some grass from the master, but he doesn't realize the grass is everywhere. He could be a free man or a free ass. Right, but he's thinking, if I don't work very hard, I won't be able to eat, and therefore he's compared in our tradition to the Shudra, or one who thinks I've got to be employed, and therefore by that in employment, he suffers so much humiliation at the hands of his employer. Thinking that, but I've got to. We probably hear it a lot. I know in the UK we hear it. I'm sorry, but it's my job. Even when a policeman stops Sankirtan devotees, I'm sorry to do this, but it's my job. It takes on a certain absolute sense. I've got to do it because I've got to eat. That's the kind of underlying message. That is the reason why the scripture uses the term ass and cow. It's trying to differentiate human life from animal life. It is not simply a derogatory, pejorative term that we use of others we don't like. I remember the war comics I used to read when I was at school, and they were usually about the battle between England and Germany to get back to... feelings of patriotism and so on. And, you know, there'd be... I always remember the phrase, you know, English a pig. or something like that in there. And in warfare, one dehumanizes the enemy, which makes it easier to actually kill them. That objectification, we don't see the self within, but we somehow demonize them or objectify them. So there are reasons why Shastra uses terms like cow or an ass. It's not just a way of putting other people down in an attempt to raise our own status. Our own status being we who belong to this religion. That's not the purpose. And we should be carefully understand that. But this is an interesting verse because it begins with the root of the problem, which is identification with the body. By the way, false ego doesn't mean, I've heard it used quite a lot here. False ego, we often use it in the kind of more Freudian sense, where it means pride. And of course, it may have a link to the word pride, but actually false ego literally means identification, false identity, or identification with this body. That's actually what it means. That may lead to pride and so much else, and we may have an inflated sense of self. That's true, but it actually means false identification with the body. It's somewhat like if you look at a television screen, we start to identify with what's going on. Some years ago, I remember, I just happened to be in a house regarding printing a book. It was about devotional service, but I went to some devotee. His parents were Hindu people, and in the living room, they had this huge television. And it was left on when we went in. That's very often the culture. And generally, in more respectable families, when you go in there, the television will be turned off. That's kind of etiquette. But in some families, it's left on. So it just happened because my wife's from Greece, and I did promise not to mention her in this class. There was a football match between Greece and someone else on, and so they were talking about, and we gradually got into it. And before long, I was starting to feel happiness, because naturally I'm connected to my wife, and I wanted Greece to win. So before long, I was starting to feel happiness when Greece were doing well. That's the nature. We feel emotions on the basis of this illusion. We start to, but if we don't have nothing to do with it, we're okay, we're free of that. But almost tempted that there may be some pleasure there, we go there, and then we start to feel fear and other negative emotions as well. They may not win. But just see how it's based on that false identification. We start to connect to it. But we're not there. We're nothing to do with that place, which is perhaps 50 miles away, or so how many miles away. We're actually in the living room here, and we were there to talk about a book, something Krishna conscious. But somehow we've been distracted, and we start to feel, that's the false ego. But then that false ego is extended, you see, how it extends. We start to think the relatives, we have an eternal relationship with our relatives, therefore everlasting love, the aspiration, there was one song, everlasting love, right? We want that, we want, and so on. The interesting thing is, we're going to come to this a little later, is how these things are material, but actually they start to be connected somehow to religion and spirituality. I want to come to that in a minute. And we come to it now. Well, we could explain it now in terms of relatives. We often have this idea that we will meet our relatives again in heaven. And we know there are problems with that with regards to how old my relatives are when we get back to heaven. And other more challenging moral questions are about whether my dog will be there as well. There are problems, and so there is that tendency to mix, to conflate the mundane with the religious, and that goes on. First, I identify with the body, then I actually start to think that I have an eternal relationship with my relatives, or an intrinsic relationship with my relatives, and then I think that the land of my birth is somehow worshipable. See how the religion is getting mixed in. And then finally, it extends more explicitly to religion by saying pilgrimage is considered usually a religious activity. We go there simply to take a bath. Now, the point Srila Prabhupada makes here is that, and this is key, is that place has got to be at a distance from our country. I remember when I was living in Oxford, I never went to see all the sites that everyone else went to see, and it was really great to see all these Americans and others and to meditate how they were spending hundreds and thousands of pounds and coming to Oxford to see the sites, and I lived there. It was very good for my pride. Possibly for my false ego, I need to consider that. But that sense of why? I was in Oxford, I lived there. I didn't need to go and look at the tourist sites. You have to go somewhere else. But when you're there, it doesn't mean... So similarly, pilgrimage tends to be the same. We have to go to a distant place beyond our country. Interestingly, Srila Prabhupada says to bathe, which means ritual. You engage in some ritual, rather than to meet the men of transcendental knowledge. And of course, that transcendental knowledge reflects back on the beginning of the verse, a human being who identifies with the body. We need to stop this identification. So there are some interesting features of this verse. We could unpack them more. But the conclusion is that this identification with a particular country is illusory. Right? It's illusory. How then is Bharatvarsh special according to this verse? Is that not a contradiction? And actually many people will conflate religion, which has its ideas of transcendence, with the mundane. For example, I've got examples. Conflate means to put together. And often in an unthoughtful way, we conflate two things. We mix them up. We think they're the same, but they're two separate things. We have, for example, and this is a phrase that I really have difficulty with personally, is we hear in the Old Testament, the God of Israel, as if... Of course, it may be, more recently, I've actually thought that they may be using it more in the sense of Ishtadev, your kind of chosen deity. But from our perspective, the God of Israel is really hard to really get to grips with because God is beyond a particular country. We often see, and I've seen this particularly in America, they make an oath of allegiance to their country and then an oath of allegiance to their creed. Because we're not creedal, you know. We don't pay obeisances to a particular set of beliefs. Although we have a philosophy, and we need to be philosophically loyal. We also have the ideas of sacred languages. Languages become sacred. And languages are connected to people and countries and regions. Arabic is sacred. Aramaic, Greek is considered very important. Sanskrit, Tamil, Pali. Even early modern Dutch is still important to some Calvinists. So, and then actually the scholars separate sacred languages from divine languages, and the divine languages are those that are also spoken or have some roots in the spiritual realm as Sanskrit. I'll read a quote. Church founder Sun Young Moon has instructed all Unification Church members to learn Korean because Korean is the language closest to God's heart and the future world language will be Korean. Indeed, we may laugh, but there are questions about us also saying perhaps Sanskrit or Bengali, however badly we speak it, is a sacred language. True. There are questions here. So the problem is that the profane becomes sacred Ignorance is justified by connection to something absolute. Another example is Hindu nationalism. But I have a question. If we describe Hinduism, I know there are issues about Hinduism, but some people describe it, and they think this may be right, as an Indian religion, then it's only a short step from saying Hinduism is an Indian religion to saying India is a Hindu country. It's a short step. And there are those who want that. And therefore, there was the saying, Bande Mataram, worship Bande Mataram, the mother, Mother India. And actually, there are pictures, if you go to India, of a deity, Mother India, which one can worship. So very often, religion has become conflated with or mixed with national identities, also in Greece, because Greece was under the Ottoman Empire for 400 years at least. People sought refuge in spirituality and religion at that time. But the result was that actually the national identity and the religious identity became inseparable. Therefore, you'll find on all the monasteries and churches the Greek flag. So what is our approach? And what's our approach to India? Coming back to India, what is our approach to India? I used to largely equate India with the spiritual. I'd like to share a couple of personal experiences. And the first was the first time I went to India. And I remember driving to Mayapur from Calcutta and having visions of the front cover of a Back to Godhead with kind of lotuses and swans and rivers barely 20 meters wide with crystal clear water, and being somewhat disappointed upon seeing this gigantic kind of muddy river and other aspects of India which didn't seem to quite match the front of the BTG cover. It was quite a shock for me. I'm not sure if I've got over it. The second was driving. I used to think that driving in India was transcendental. I thought there was something funny about the driving in India. It didn't seem to follow any kind of rules or laws, and yet somehow or other it seemed to work. However, I did have the pleasure, or the privilege, I should say, of actually traveling to India with Tamil Krishna Goswami the last time he went there. That changed my opinion about driving in India. Was it so transcendental? Mm-hmm. So we see, how special is it? I must say, as the longer I actually I live, I tend to increasingly view India as a 19th century British colonialist. Is it special? What is special there? A few more pertinent questions then. Is my dhoti spiritual, or is it Bengali? If it was born in Bengal. If it was bought in Bengal. Is it spiritual? Do the gopis wear saris, as we know them today? Where did they buy them from? Should we offer potatoes to Krishna? Chilies? Should we offer pizza to Krishna? Can we offer veggie burgers to Krishna? What about veggie sausages? If I wear wooden shoes, will I hear more clearly Srila Prabhupada on my iPod? I'm just raising questions. But perhaps we're more to do with Bengal rather than, perhaps we're more Bengali than Indian. But many holy places are now in Bangladesh. It's a Muslim country. So our tradition definitely isn't to do with the nation. But those places still are somehow special to us, legitimately. Obviously, they're legitimate. But how do we understand that? The other question is a rather tricky one here. How is it that Krishna's Leela appears to resemble Indian village life. It involves cows, dhotis, turbans, and tamal trees, rather than dogs walked by men in pinstripe trousers, bowler hats, and who appreciate the mighty oak tree. Sometimes it seems that we may think that actually Krishna's pastimes reflect India in a way. Is this not anthropomorphic? Is it not something that we've taken our own experience and we're projecting it onto the absolute? These are difficult questions. We're in a difficult situation here, not because we live in Belgium, but we're kind of stuck. We say in England we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. On one hand, it seems clearly an absurdity to reject that our tradition and our personal spirituality has anything to do with India. If we say we've got nothing to do with India, it seems absurd. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is from there, our tradition has some connection. It's equally untenable to claim that we are just non-sectarian, universal. Well, we might claim we're non-sectarian, but there are difficulties in saying we're just non-sectarian. And for us, America is the same as India. Or even worse, America is the same as the UK. Goodness. And furthermore, we are the only people who are sectarian. We are the most non-sectarian. We are the most non-sectarian. So how do we avoid these kind of extremes, these absurdities? So on one side, we may claim that India is we may claim some connection to India, but or Bengal or our tradition, but we may be sectarian. We may be reinforcing our false identity. But on the other side, we claim that we're fully non-sectarian, perhaps to take the moral high ground, whilst running around Red Square, you know where Red Square is, in orange bed sheets from Loy Bazaar, beating the hell out of clay Bengali drums, while singing highly repetitive songs in Sanskrit with a Russian accent. I've noticed the Russians have a particular way of chanting Hare Krishna. Having just eaten pizza offered to an Indian god by a pujari from the Ukraine, whose guru is an American Jew, despite his father being from what is now Uzbekistan. I could go on and on and on. How do we understand this? There seem to be some elements of what we're doing which clearly have some connection with India and so on. I've raised some questions. What I'd like to do is look at some possible answers to these. Firstly, in this purport, there is the idea that India is the most pious land. It's interesting because here is a type of discrimination not based just on the people or the country, but on piety. It's an interesting concept. So we're actually discriminating on the basis of impiety or piety. In other words, we're discriminating on the basis of virtues or values. This is an interesting way of discriminating because it is very much prevalent in our tradition that any form of discernment is based on values rather than bodily designation. There's one point I'd like us to hang on to. Second one, in regards to what I just said, which is rather confrontational, about India resembling the spiritual world, or the spiritual world resembling India, it may be that India, or certain places of the world, or certain sites, more closely resemble the spiritual. It may be the opposite way around. Thirdly, and I found this a powerful argument, and I've termed this Malayan sandalwood. Now, if you think I'm asking difficult questions and that we shouldn't really engage with such apparent contradictions or tensions, think again. because I'd like you to consider the section where Queen Kunti is glorifying Lord Krishna. It's interesting because she's glorifying him, but at the same time she's posing questions. These paradoxes in one sense, or apparent contradictions, could seem to be paradoxical, but actually she's glorifying Krishna through them. It's an interesting concept. O Lord, no one can understand your transcendental pastimes, which appear to be human, and so are misleading. You have, and that's one contradiction. You're transcendental, but you have human pastimes, or they appear to be human. You have no specific object of favor, nor do you have any object of envy. Generally speaking, when we're born, we already have someone we favor and someone we are the object of our hate or envy, depending on the country you're born. People only imagine that you are partial. So Krishna appears to be partial, but he can't be because he's God. But he appears to be partial, the problem of evil. Of course, it is bewildering, O soul of the universe, that you work, though you are inactive, and that you take birth, though you are the vital force and the unborn. You yourself descend amongst animals, men, sages, and aquatics. Verily, this is idambanam, bewildering. And relating to this transcendental month of Damodar, again an interesting conflation of the possibly of the mundane and the sacred, but it's fine. It's a sacred month of Damodar. My dear Krishna, Yashoda took up a rope to bind you when you committed an offense, and your perturbed eyes overflooded with tears which washed the mascara from your eyes. And you were afraid, although fear personified is afraid of you. This sight is bewildering to me. So Krishna becomes fearful. But fear, can you imagine? You know what it's like when we feel fearful. We can reflect on a time we were really fearful. So fear personified. Can you imagine that? Fear personified. We have this tradition in ISKCON also, in our tradition of actually looking at personifications. I remember my brother told me a story. He was walking down the corridor in the manor, and he overheard a conversation of a lady who had obviously got quite a heavy cold. I'm mucus personified today. Mucus personified. Anyway, it's quite amusing how some of these concepts come into ISKCON and they're used colloquially. But we have this idea of personification. That's fine. So fear personified, you can imagine. But fear personified is fearful of Krishna. But yet Krishna here appears to be fearful. And this goes on. I'd like to focus on one of these aspects, and that is how Krishna is identified, not specifically with a country here, but with the Yadus and a particular family or dynasty. For Kunti, the god of Israel, was not an option. So she was aware of this. But how can God be a Yadava? There are still Yadavas, members of the Yadu dynasty in India. Let me read this. Kunti is exploring possible answers here, or giving certain answers. And I'll read the verse. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings. And others say that he is born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family, this means the Yadu dynasty, as sandalwood appears in the Malaya hills. I'll read the verse. The appearance of Lord Krishna is compared to the growth of sandalwood trees in the Malaya hills. There are two Malayas, the Malaya Hills and part of the world now known as Malaysia. The Chandan tree or sandalwood tree can grow anywhere. There is no rule that it has to grow in Malaysia or the Malaya Hills. But because this sandalwood grows in large quantities in those parts of the world, it is known as Malaya Chandan. In the Western countries, there is a scented water known as Eau de Cologne. It can be manufactured anywhere, but because it was originally manufactured in the city of Cologne, it is known as Eau de Cologne. And Srila Prabhupada says elsewhere, that's from the teachings of Queen Kunti. He also says in the Srimad Bhagavatam, from which this is, those prayers are based, that book is based, trees can grow anywhere and everywhere, yet because the sandalwood trees grow mostly in the area of the Malaya Hills, the name sandalwood and the Malaya Hills are interrelated. Does that make sense? What can we draw from this? Krishna had to appear somewhere. He appeared mostly in India. Prabhupada explains that the incarnations are also appear outside of India. He says that categorically, but mainly in India. That's another argument. I think it's an interesting one to meditate on, because Krishna appeared in India, or largely in India, therefore it's special. I'm also going to come up with a fourth idea. Goodness. And then I'll finish. And that is the idea of a global village. If you can, the idea of global village is closely associated with an author who wrote some books, Global Village. But I'll be brief on this. It refers to the idea that the world is shrinking through modern communications. Mm-hmm. We know what's going on. You know, our gramya katha, our village talk, is through the internet, particularly, extends to the whole world. So we can talk about what's going on, who's doing what scandals are there, who's been naughty, who we want to condemn, all these things on a global level. Therefore, if we consider this a village, and a village or a town or a city has its different areas, it has a shopping center, an industrial estate, a housing estate, a golf course, places we have recreation. Where is the temple in this global village? And my own deliberation, and it was completely my own deliberation, was that in that global village, the natural choice for the temple is India. And then I found a verse. I'm very happy when I find verses that support my own point of view. So we Indians, we should know that we cannot imitate the Western countries. They're far advanced. So far, the materialistic way of life is concerned, you cannot compete with them. Just like some years before, there was an industrial exhibition in India in which the government was very proud to show they were manufacturing cycles and sewing machines. When the Western part of the world, they were manufacturing so many complicated machineries, we are proud of cycles and sewing machines. Similarly, in every respect, in medicine also, there are many laboratories in India, but still 75% of them, Prabhupada goes on, 75% of the medicine is imported. So my point is that in every country, in human society, there is a special qualification. The day before yesterday, I was seeing one picture of that church of Hardwar. Millions of people assembled there for taking bath in the Ganges. In 1958, there was a special fair at Jagannath Puri. You'll be surprised to know that for a few hour visit, about 6 million people assembled from all parts of India. Srila Prabhupada goes on. So different people have different propensities, different lands have different propensities. And I think the idea that actually India is the sense of spirituality. Srila Prabhupada goes on, this means that while the Indian youths are coming to the Western countries for advancement of technological knowledge, the Western boys and girls, they're hankering after spiritual life. And he talks about Western people, and they expect something spiritual from India. He talks about a Chinese gentleman, a very learned man, who recommends, if you want to study religion as it is, then you have to go to India. So there is, I'm making an argument here that actually, if we consider the world a global village, then the temple is India. I'm not saying actually there's not spirituality to be found elsewhere, and I can't finish here because we don't have time, but as well as raising questions about what is our identity with India, how are we related to India, we could also ask how are we related to our own cultures. And I think that's a very important question we have to ask. And because there's an allusion here to piety and values, there are some devotees who are suggesting, some scholars, that we as devotees need to engage with the best in our own culture. Because there are similar ideas there, and there are similar virtues there. There is that verse, that song called Jerusalem, which actually, even though we may say that the British conflate religion with nationality, but there's a similar idea that actually because Jesus Christ walked upon that land, it has become sacred. And did those feet in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green? It's a similar idea. No, don't get sentimental and patriotic. Don't start singing. But the question is, even though we may say, okay, India has something special, but we also need to relate to the spirituality that is there in our own country and the best of those values. Mm-hmm. And that may be something that we actually look at here. I can't go through everything, but I think it's interesting here. Rishabhadev was an avaduta, and yet his son, Bharat, has become quite central to nationalism. On one side, an avaduta, completely free of all social constraints. On the other side, his son has become a symbol, or his name has become used in the name of nationalism. So we do need to understand our relationship to India. We also need to relate, in a sense, deal with our material identity as we understand it now, even though it may be ultimately illusory. We have to somehow deal with that, and in our preaching work we have to do it. And actually I was going to say, and I didn't have time to explore it, but our attitude towards diversity, particularly if we think something is better, is that it means greater responsibility. Matra spashas to kunteya shitoshna shukadukada agamat po yuto nitas tongues to tikshvasva bharata. Bharata, the same word. Krishna is addressing Arjuna, Bharata, and son of Kunti on his mother's side and his father's side. Why is he addressing him like that in this verse, telling him about his mother and his father, his parentage? Why? Because Srila Prabhupada says, because a great heritage brings responsibility. And therefore, if any of us are proud of actually our connection with India, our connection with our spiritual heritage, or our connection with our own country, it isn't a way of boosting our false ego, our sense of identity. It is a way of actually, it must be seen as this brings responsibility. I'll leave it there. Questions? We only have a few minutes. Yes. Kanchanavali. Yes. Yeah, that is true. Yeah. Absolutely. So there's a kind of transcendental meaning to that as well. Yeah. Good. Any other? Thank you. Any other question or comment on this? Okay. Yeah. I mean, Prabhupada, you're right. I mean, Srila Prabhupada is making the point that actually India is not known for its bicycles and sewing machines. It's known for its spirituality. Of course, if India does become economically more healthy, and there are indications of that, if you look what's going on in Greece and Italy and so on at the moment, you know, Europe isn't doing very well, and Spain. it may actually attract attention more to Indian culture, and it may be useful for us. But Srila Prabhupada's point is, yes, that actually the strength of India is in its spirituality. So it's a little ironic again, isn't it? The strength of India is in its spirituality, because spirituality means something which is transcendental. But still, yes, if it has anything, it must be that in its spirituality. And you'd be surprised. I mean, even in, you know, I'm thinking of the UK, you know, the ideas of yoga and meditation are really integrated into society these days. And, you know, the connection to India is clear. There is, you know, some appreciation of that spirituality there. I think that's true. People have a fascination with it. But how we you know, how we negotiate our own identity is an important one. And I think that's the point I'd like to leave here. I've probably raised more questions than we've answered. But I'd also like us to finish by considering how we identify with those who are most spiritual and inclined to the glorification of God, I will add, in our own cultures, because they're there. They are there. You go to any country, you will find a class of people who are more elevated. They're more pious. As Srila Prabhupada said, it's the most pious country, but there's piety in other countries. He says that point very, very clearly. So we will find pious people. If we recognize that people, there are pious people, and you know, have that positive view that there are pious people, while recognizing there are those who are really demoniac as well, we should also recognize that. But then actually, perhaps that will help us be, I think, more effective in our preaching. There is something we can relate to in Belgium. There is, you know, there is something in the culture that has a connection to Krishna consciousness. We can endorse that and build on that. And we need to show what can Krishna consciousness, even though it seems to be coming from somewhere else, apparently add to that in a positive way. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.